Now this spear is now the spear that goes from Longinus to Queen Boadicea and then Charlemagne and obviously Constantine. This is the one that traces itself to Vienna today, right?
That's
what Vienna says?
Yeah, what we know about the one in Vienna is much more convoluted than that. We know that Boadicea had a spear. We do not know if it is indeed Longinus' spear or not. But if you do a Google search on Boadicea, you will see every image of her shows her with her spear.
Yeah.
With the next person that is recorded as having it is Saint Maurice. And Maurice was about 200 years later. Maybe 180 years later. Maurice was the leader of the Theban Legion. He was a Roman legionnaire who led a legion. And not just any legion, this legion all came from, they were all people recruited or press ganged or whatever around the city of Thebes in ancient Egypt. And at this point in time, you know, Thebes had been the capital of dynastic of the later dynasty of Egypt for thousands of years. It was known as Thebes of a Thousand Gates. Well, a town with a thousand gates is kind of hard to defend, and the Romans sacked it.
Yeah.
So the Egyptians moved their capital to a more defensive location, and eventually the city of Thebes became what is today the city of Luxor. The Theban Legion were all Christians, and Caesar was putting down a revolt in Gaul, which is today France, and he needed, he didn't have enough legions in France to do it, so he called the Theban Legion to join in, and the story goes is that they marched, they sailed to Italy and then marched over the Alps, and their marching was so loud, they became known as the Thundering Legion. When they arrived in Gaul, there was a bit of a problem. The Romans had a rather odd way of maintaining discipline. They did something called decimation. You may have heard the term, you know, we decimated them. Well, the word decimation is based on the word deca, which is 10. To decimate means to literally kill 1 in 10. The German occupiers during World War II used decimation against villages when there was a partisan attack on German forces. The Germans would go into the town and line up the men and kill 1 in 10 just to make a point.
Yeah.
Well, the Roman legionnaires, if a Roman legion really screwed up, the Caesar could order that they decimate themselves, and they would do it. I mean, better 1 in 10 than everybody.
Exactly. Yeah.
So the Theban Legion, the Thundering Legion, arrived in Gaul, and there was the Caesar ordered that there should be a celebration to the gods, either before or after the war. It's after the battle. It's not really clear exactly when this happened. It may have been to ask the gods to help, or it may have been to thank the gods for their help. But at any rate, Caesar maintained he was a god. In fact, he maintained that he was the god Hercules. And the Theban Legion refused to name him as a god, refused to say, yeah, you are God. And this pissed the Caesar off.
Yeah.
So Caesar ordered, you know, if you guys don't claim me God, don't name me God, I'm gonna decimate you. And they said, okay, do it. So he ordered a decimation. And they did it. And while they're doing it, Maurice, who's the leader of the Legion, holds up the Spear of Christ and reminds them with it that they are Christians, and that there is no king but Jesus. And they do the decimation and report back to Caesar, well, we've done it, and we're still not going to name you God. At which point Caesar orders a second decimation, and they do it again. And they joyously choose lots and willingly throw themselves on each other's swords.
Yeah.
And they send back to Caesar, we've done it, and we're still not going to name you God. At which point Caesar orders all of them destroyed. And one legion goes over, and they offer no resistance. They all go down to a man. And this brings up an aspect of the Holy Lands that George and I tried to figure out in our book, Secrets of the Holy Lands, in that it seems from this point on that the spear is very intimately involved in sacrifice.
Yeah.
That wherever the spear goes, there are oceans of blood. And I have heard for decades that a number of people think that the Holocaust during World War II was a covert human sacrifice.
Yeah.
And that rings true with the spear. And one of the things that George looked at was perhaps the spear, when it was pierced, when it was pressed into the side of God, got God coming through it, or rather took an imprint of that moment.
Yeah.
And that is the purpose of the crucifixion, we're told in the Bible, was so that God could redeem us, that it was to be the last human sacrifice, that God would sacrifice himself to himself for us. So did the spear take on that need to sacrifice? Did it get embodied with sacrifice, but because it's just a hunk of metal, it doesn't really understand what its message, what's going on, and it just keeps radiating need to sacrifice, and that people get it, and they find themselves, well, let's have a human sacrifice this week.
Yeah. Now, you speak to the Holy Land sort of as like an opposite or a yin-yang effect with the lost ark, with the Holy Grail.
Well, there are a number of tie-ins, very much so, particularly that the Ark of the Covenant was one of the things the Nazis were looking for. They had the Spear of Destiny, and they were looking for all of the great artifacts. They were looking for all the relics of the Passion. And I'm not really quite sure why, to tell you the truth.
Seems like the Holy Lance is like an opposite almost of those other relics too, in that the Holy Lance appears throughout history, but the Ark of the Covenant and the Holy Grail are sort of like so shadowy that you don't have a lot of instances in history where people are saying they have it. It's only like rumored to be had, but with the Lance, there's clear stories of possession.
Right, right, and possession is an interesting term in that... As I was writing the book, I'm a big Lord of the Rings fan, and I've read the Lord of the Rings about 30 times. And as I was working on this book, I began to realize that there were a lot of parallels between the spear and the ring. That when Adolf Hitler first sees the spear in 1907 or 1910, it talks to him. It takes over his mind and shows him something. There are numerous places. Constantine repeatedly said that it talked to him. It told him to abandon Rome and to set up a new capital. I know we're jumping ahead a bit here, but I began to realize that that's what the ring did. That I began to see that there were these tremendous parallels between the One Ring and the spear. And again, there was an emanating force. There was an evil spirit behind the One Ring, and there seems to be an evil spirit behind the spear. If the stories about the spear are true, the supernatural that comes through either can be warped or is warped.
Yeah. And you speak to that they tested, they scientifically tested the Holy Land.
Oh, right, right. We were covering the Spear in Vienna. This, and I got off on the Spear in Vienna. We have solid evidence of solid provenance, a chain of custody on it from about 1400 to 1938.
Yeah.
Prior to 1400, from 800 to 1400, it's believed to be the same object.
Yeah.
You can kind of trace back the provenance to Charlemagne. Prior to Charlemagne, all bets are off. But we do know that St. Maurice had some spear, which was believed to be the spear.
Yeah.
And then Constantine the Great had a spear that was believed to be the spear.
And you can sort of trace the spear that you trace has an overwhelming pattern of war, and like the people that claim it, they don't just claim it and it sits around really. It's a lot of times it's an intricate part of their empire building and empire collapse, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. Particularly right after Constantine, there were numerous possessors of it who used it in battle. Not necessarily using it as a weapon, but having it brought with them into battle and having the battles go their way or not because of it.
Yeah.
By asking about the scientific testing, you're kind of leaping me here to the end of that trail.
Okay. Well, all right.
That's okay. I don't mind going to the end of the trail.
No, let's.
I think we should come back at some point. I can go ahead and answer that.
No. We'll get to that when we talk about present day spear and that stuff. Do you think the power of the spear sort of become like a well-known, I don't want to say urban legend, because back then it was barely urban at all, but when did it sort of become a known thing with Queen Boadicea?
I don't think so. It was probably with Constantine. What we know about Constantine comes from a Christian priest who was sort of imagine if you know the relationship between like Billy Graham and American presidents. Well, this priest had that same relationship to the latter emperors of the Roman Empire, and I'm never really quite sure how to pronounce his name. I think it's something like Eusebius,
yeah.
Eusebius. Eusebius of Caesarea, and he wrote Life of Constantine, in it he is very, very adamant that Constantine had the spear of the Christ and knew he had the spear of the Christ and used it in a very dramatic way. It was always marched at the head of Constantine's armies. When Constantine called the Council of Nicaea, he held it in his hand the whole time during the entire conference. Well, let's back up a bit here. Constantine may have gotten it from his father-in-law, who was the same Caesar who ordered the decimation of the Theban Legion.
Yeah.
And we speculate, we there's nowhere was it recorded how or when Constantine got the spear. So we attempted to bridge that gap by guessing that if Caesar Maximinus Augustus killed the Theban Legion and they had the spear, it may have been brought to him as a trophy.
Yeah.
And he may have had a vague idea of what it was about. We know that Constantine, the rule of law, the rule of the Roman Empire at that point in time is hard to understand. It is so alien to the way we run things that it's I spent months researching Constantine. The publisher wanted the book in 2 months, and we actually turned it in 6.5.
Oh, wow.
And most of that time, I spent researching Constantine.
Oh, wow.
There was an emperor, Diocletian. Diocletian decided that the empire was simply too big for one man to rule. And much to everybody's surprise, he appointed a co-emperor, Maximinus. And they each named themselves as being gods. Max calls himself Hercules, and I forget, Diocletian, I think, called himself Job. Well, after a while, Diocletian gets an illness and abdicates and forces Max to abdicate with him. Well, before they do this, they have set up Diocletian decides that two guys, the empire is so big, two guys can't handle it. So he sets up two junior emperors. And so there are two senior emperors and two junior emperors.
So they're just setting themselves up for turf wars, pretty much.
Yeah, exactly. So Diocletian takes Galerius as his junior emperor, and Max takes Constantine's father, Constantinus Chlorus, as his junior emperor. Well, they... a number of strange things happen, and it ends up with Max's son holed up in Rome, claiming to be the one and only emperor, and Constantinus Chlorus's son being in charge of Constantine Chlorus's army. Chlorus had just died, and the soldiers proclaimed Constantine emperor. And oddly enough, this was the norm for the last several hundred years of the empire. The soldiers proclaimed who the emperor was going to be. The darndest thing. So Constantine finds himself marching on Rome. And his brother-in-law. There is a famous battle, the Battle of the Milvian Bridge, which this is where the spear really appears. And we have a website, secretsoftheholylands.com. Mm-hmm. Easy to remember is simply spearbook.com.
Yes.
Just type in spearbook.com, it'll take you over to it. And we have an image gallery of important images of all this stuff. And one is a famous painting of Constantine fighting the Battle of Milvian Bridge. And in this painting, you see he's holding the Holy Lands, and there's an angel floating over his head.
Oh, wow.
Now, what had happened was, on his way to Rome, Constantine had the spear and had a vision. And this is one of the most famous stories in Christendom. I'd heard about it most of my life. Cornell Wilde starred in a 1960 Bible epic called Constantine and the Cross. It's a sort of an amusing, nutty little film. The only thing they get right is the names. One scene in the movie actually happened in reality, which was Constantine Chlorus's troops proclaiming his son Constantine emperor. That's the only scene in the entire movie that actually happened.
Oh, man.
So as Constantine is marching on Rome, he has the spear and he has a vision, and he sees in the sky a sign, and he hears the phrase, "With this sign you will conquer." Now that, in today's parlance, is clairvoyance and clairaudience.
Yeah.
He sees a vision. He sees the sign, and the sign is it looks like a capital P superimposed with a capital X. It's called the Labrum, and it is the first two letters in the name of Christ written in Greek. He then had that sign. It wasn't, he didn't see a cross, even though the movie shows him seeing a cross. He sees this odd Greek symbol and has the Greek symbol, orders the Greek symbol painted on the shields of all his soldiers. When he gets to Rome, not only does he beat his brother-in-law back, but in the attempt to escape back into the city, the would-be emperor finds himself crossing on a bridge of wooden boats, and it all goes to hell in a handbasket on him. He falls into the river and is drowned. Constantine then goes on to become one of the two co-emperors. At that point, there are, I think, three co-emperors, and of course, you know, three men cannot run a government very well.
Yeah.
And one of them immediately realizes that he's at the wrong end of the stick and starts a battle which he can't win, though he tries. And Constantine goes after him and fights numerous battles and kills maybe a million people. I mean,
oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, there are some battles in a single day where 25 or 30,000 people die.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it was gruesome. And again, this is the oceans of blood wherever the spear goes.
Exactly.
One of the things that came up in this is one of the battles is a sea battle in which Constantine has 5,000 ships. His opponent has 7,000 ships. He's way outnumbered, way outgunned, and calls on the spear to help, and a big wind, an immense wind comes up, and doesn't harm any of his ships, but blows the enemy ships all over the sea, drowning 5,000 sailors in the afternoon.
Nice.
Yeah, and then this big wind comes up again. It's repeated. There are numerous battles in which the spear takes part, in which this big wind appears, and we were astonished to discover that it wasn't a part of the legend, and yet there it is, repeatedly occurring. One of Constantine's descendants, about four emperors after Constantine, maybe five emperors after Constantine, goes into battle with the spear, and the wind comes up behind him, and he wins the battle because one of the chroniclers of it wrote, The wind was so strong it kept blowing the enemy's swords back into their faces.
Huh. Now, one of the things I liked about the book especially was how you try to trace back a little bit about where the spear may have come from before it even came to Longinus. And the story that really fascinated me was Tubal Cain.
Right.
And the E.T. metal.
Right.
Talk a little bit about that.
That was a chapter written by George. And I'm not, I really don't know any more about it than you do.
Yeah.
There are a couple of legends as to how the spear got made. One of the legends, mentioned, I believe, in the Gospel of Nicodemus, is that the spear had some sort of magic on it, that it had been given by Julius Caesar to Longinus' grandfather for bravery in battle, and grandfather passed it to father, who passed it to son, and that the spear was always sharp. It never needed sharpening, and there were some other aspects. You know, it was a magic spear of some sort or another.
Yeah.
Then there is the Tubal Cain story. One story of the origins of the spear says that it was made by Tubal Cain. Tubal Cain, the seventh generation grandson of Adam, of course has the curse of his family on him, and his family is, his people are not faring well, and in Hebraic lore, he's seen as the first blacksmith. He's seen as the archetypical worker in metals. And I'm sure he is more mythological than real.
Yeah.
But the story goes that Tubal-Cain's people are being overrun by the other people, and he calls upon God to help him, and a burning meteorite falls out of the sky, and he collects up this meteor metal and fashions a spear and a sword, and the sword becomes Excalibur, and the spear becomes the Spear of Longinus. Then there's another story, which is the spear of Phineas. Phineas was a Hebrew prophet way back in the year Umpty-Ump. And Phineas's spear is a spear of tribal power. Whoever possesses it runs the tribe. And it came down to Herod. And the last time anybody knew for sure where it was is Herod had it. So it's not impossible that Longinus may have acquired it from Herod. We don't pick up that story for a number of reasons. One is we couldn't get any good scholarship on it, and we didn't like the tie-in, and we just ran out of space for it.
Yeah.
You know, we were supposed to turn in a book that was 300 pages, and we turned in a book that was 350 pages.
Yeah, so you guys had more than enough stuff. It was even like you had to parse it down anyway, right?
Exactly.
Now, you go through a lot of the different people that had the spear, claimed to have the spear.
Right. We tried to establish the chain of custody, the provenance for the piece. And also, many of the people have bizarre metaphysical events occur with it.
Yeah.
As I said, Constantine was only one of many who had supernatural phenomena occur. Constantine, as well as winning the Battle of the Milvian Bridge with it, then has it talk to him and tell him that Rome is not appropriate, that Rome won't do as his capital, and tells him to move it to this little Greek town called Byzantium. And he moves to Byzantium, and as he's laying out the new city, which he names Nova Roma, New Rome, he says repeatedly that he's following in the footsteps of him who he sees walking before him. He keeps telling people that I can see Christ walking around, and Christ is telling me how to lay out the city, and I'm just telling you what he's telling me.
Oh, wow.
That was pretty amazing.
Yeah, I'll say. One of the stories that I actually was really amused by, because it sort of goes against the grain of how everybody wanted the spear, was the Attila the Hun story. It's kind of a short one, but it's pretty humorous. So why?
Yeah, I thought that was hilarious. It goes that there have been several consecutive rulers of the Roman Empire who have used the spear successfully, and one of them had Attila as one of his adjutants, I forget military words, you know, like colonel.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the Huns had been initially they'd been held out of the Roman Empire, and then they'd been invited in. And when they were invited in, they were made members of the of the community, which included members of the army. And they were promised that they would be paid. And so they fought with the Romans, fought for the Romans, and then they didn't get paid. And then they fought against the Romans, and kept demanding pay. And both the Huns and the Romans jacked each other around. They both made promises and then failed to keep them.
Yeah.
And finally, Attila takes Rome, and he's the first guy in 800 years to take Rome. And the reason was is because the new emperor was a kid who didn't understand that the power of the spear, and his father had the spear on display in Milan, and the kid left it there. And apparently, Attila, on his march to Rome, picked it up and gets to Rome. And the reason he takes Rome is because he has the spear.
Yeah.
He's in Rome for a while, for a week. pillaging and raping. Once they've taken everything that was nailed down, or, you know, everything that wasn't, you know, everything that was movable got moved.
Yeah.
And as they're leaving, he rides back and throws the spear into the dust at the feet of the Pope and says, "Take back your holy land, so I know not him who made it holy."
Yeah, so he just gives it right up. That's the strangest thing. That really struck me as odd. And then going through who possessed the spear.
Yeah, let me pick up. After Constantine, there is a fairly well-established provenance, a chain of custody for about 6 or 8 emperors, about 300 years worth, more or less. And the last one we know to have it is Justinian. And again, the spear spoke to Justinian and told Justinian that it was okay for him to close down the Hellenistic schools, to close every school that was not teaching the Bible. So the Bible became literally the only book you could read. And even then, you couldn't read it unless you were of the ruling class.
Yes.
So that's what gave us the Dark Ages. Justinian is revered as one of the greatest people by the Catholics, and just about everybody else thinks he was one of the greatest jerks of all time. Not only did he give us the Dark Ages, but he also gave us a well endowed Islam, because he was an Eastern Roman emperor, and he wanted to rule the entire empire, which the empire had lost the western half of the empire for 100 years, and he squanders a huge fortune and fights a battle and does succeed in taking back the western half of the empire. Well, and while he's doing this, he's paying off the Persians he's paying them to not invade. So the Persians get rich doing nothing, while he drains the empire. After him, the spear disappears, and it disappears for 300-400 years.
It disappears for that long a time. Then how does it reappear after it's gone through the cycle of emperors? You said it disappears for a while. How does it reappear?
Nobody really knows. Most of the time when people get the spear, it's not recorded how they got it. It's just recorded, and our glorious emperor has the spear. In this case, Charlemagne had himself proclaimed the first emperor of the Holy Roman Empire on Christmas Day, 800 A.D., and he is dubbed the emperor by the Pope using the Holy Lance. And nobody really knows how it came to him, but there is an interesting facet. He was the king of the Franks, and the Franks are the people who today are the French and the Germans.
Yeah.
There were two major branches of the Franks, two major tribes of Franks, and they were the Merovingians and the Carolingians. The Merovingians may ring a bell with some of your listeners. If you saw the second Matrix movie, a character is named the Merovingian.
Yeah.
This is a nod to conspiracy freaks out there, and particularly to the Da Vinci Code freaks.
Yeah.
In that one of the stories related is that there is this organization called the Priory de Sion, and the Priory de Sion maintains that the Holy Grail was not a cup to hold the blood of Jesus, it was the bloodline of Jesus. And that Jesus was married to Mary and had children. And the descendants of the offspring were the rulers of the Franks, were the Merovingians. Now the last Merovingian king was offed by the Pope. That was Dagobert II. Around the same time that Charlemagne proclaimed himself. The two major branches of the Franks, the Carolingians had a tribal spear that whoever possessed, no, I take that back, the Merovingians had a tribal spear. And the spear was whoever possessed it, like the spear of Phineas, whoever possessed it was the undisputed ruler of the Franks, and it gave him the power of life or death over all Franks. Well, Constantine one-ups the tribal spear by pulling the god spear.
Yeah.
And we believe that the evidence strongly supports that it was a scam. It was a hoax, an absolutely brilliant scam. You asked me earlier about the testing of the spear in Vienna. We can establish a fairly coherent the provenance that the object in the Vienna Museum was probably, in very high probability, the same spear that dubbed Charlemagne. So from 800, Christmas Day 800 AD to 1938, we have an established track. In 2003, the spear in Vienna was tested. It was tested by a team led by Dr. Robert Feather. Feather was granted very special rights. The curator of the museum literally walked it across the street to a hotel where they'd set up a makeshift lab.
Yeah.
And Feather was allowed to take off the, we were discussing the image on the cover of the book, Secrets of the Holy Lands, and you see that there's this gold sheath in the middle.
Yes.
Well, under the gold sheath is a silver sheath, and he was allowed to take those off. Apparently what happened is the third Holy Roman Emperor decided that the spear wasn't powerful enough. It wasn't magically powerful enough by itself, and he got a nail from the true cross. Now, he had a jeweler insert the nail into the spear. Now, the jeweler carved out a piece of the spear in order to insert the nail in, and in doing this, weakened it and broke it.
Oh, man.
Now, in creating this niche to put the nail into, he created two splinters from the original spearhead. And these two splinters were then made they made replicas of the spearhead with the splinters in them, and they gave one to the King of Poland, and that spear is today in a museum in Poland, and they gave one to the King of Hungary, and that spear has long since vanished. Well, when they put the nail into the spear, and it broke the spear, so they then had to wire it all back together with this silver wire, and they put a silver sheath around it to hold it together. A couple hundred years later, another Holy Roman Emperor decided that the silver sheath wasn't fancy enough, and had a gold sheath made, and on the gold sheath it says in Latin, nail and spear of our Lord.
Yeah.
Okay, so that Dr. Robert Feather was allowed to take those sheaves off and examine it in a number of different ways. They rubbed biological swab on it to see if there was any organic matter on it. There wasn't. They did radio fluoroscoping and a number of things that I have no clue what the heck they are, but they established that the spearhead was probably made in the 6th or 7th century. Now, that would make it 100 or 200 years old when Charlemagne claimed it was the spear of Christ.
Yeah.
Well wrong. You know, it obviously could not have been.
Yeah.
It obviously could not have been the spear that Constantine had. Now, the nail is something else again. The nail does conform to a first century Roman nail, but it's very small. It probably would not have been used in a cross. It was probably more like a pin. It might have been used in like a box.
Yeah.
So it probably had nothing whatsoever to do with Christ. That's what Robert Feather and his team found.
Okay.
So the likelihood of the object in Vienna being the object is pretty slim. But there still has been from 800 to 1900 thousands of stories of strange metaphysical supernatural events occurring around this thing.
Exactly, yeah. And then it moves on to the Templar Knights, Napoleon, and then
right,
on to Hitler.
Right. What we know is that it was with the early Holy Roman Emperors, and then it vanished and was found a couple hundred years later in the Tyrolean Alps in a little monastery.
Oh, weird.
But it did have the gold and silver bands, and it was well known that those had been put on the Spirit of Christ.
Yeah.
So the emperor who found it goes, it's got to be it.
Yeah.
And I think everybody is pretty much on the same page. It's got to be it. So he then took it to Prague, which was his capital at the time, and had it on display in Prague, and then it spoke to him. And it told him that it was in danger there. And so he had it moved to the city of his birth, which was Nuremberg. And it was on display in Nuremberg for the next 400 years. Now, while it's on display in Nuremberg, it accrues this whole raft of stuff around it. It becomes part of what becomes known as the Habsburg regalia, the Reich treasure. And the Reich treasure, it consists of a spear, the spear, a sword known as the Sword of Maurice, and nobody's really quite sure why it's called the Sword of Maurice, an orb, a scepter, several crowns, and a whole bunch of strange, a whole bunch of ruling stuff.
Yeah.
And a whole bunch of religious stuff. It's like a piece of what is reported to be the tablecloth from the Last Supper, a bone from a saint, a piece of John the Baptist. I mean, this bizarre collection of things. You know, regular Ripley's Believe It or Nuts.
Yeah.
A cruise around it. Well, by the time Napoleon is on the march, it has been in Nuremberg for 400 years, and the story is known throughout Europe that whoever possesses the Holy Lands rules the world. I mean, it's the object of the Holy Roman Emperors, and so the people in Nuremberg, when Napoleon is marching on Nuremberg, they get word that he wants it, that he's going to Nuremberg to get it. And they go, whoa, if he gets it, he's going to rule the world.
Yeah.
And so they hide it. The problem is they gave it to a certain nobleman who wasn't all that noble. And he sneaks it across the border into Austria and keeps it safe from everybody. Well, Napoleon loses at Waterloo, and the Holy Roman Empire falls apart, that ceases to exist, and then the nobleman who has the Reich treasure collection goes, cool, there's no legal owner to it, I can do what I want with it, and he sells it to the Habsburgs, who have ruled Austria for 400 years, and are filthy rich, and they buy it and put it in their palace as a something for people to file through and pay a couple of shekels to see.
Yeah.
And that's where it remained until the Anschluss. That's where Adolf Hitler saw it the first time in 1907 or 1910. There are various reports. It's hard to nail down which of those two dates it really was. But Hitler, was a very down and out. He was a bum living in flop houses, and he was trying to make it as a painter. He'd been rejected from going into the art academy, and he blamed the Jews for no logical reason for keeping him out of the art academy, and he's trying to make it as a painter, and one day he just has a hissy fit and rips up all his paintings, and it's a cold, blustery fall autumn day, and he goes into the first door he sees to keep warm, and it turns out to be the museum. And he's just sort of wandering around in the museum, and he hears a tour group, and the tour guide tells points out the Holy Lands, and then tells the group he's guiding the legend of the lands, which is, whosoever possesses this Holy Lands and understands the powers it serves, holds in his hand the destiny of the world for good or evil. And Hitler goes, whoa! And after the tour group moves on, he walks over and looks at it, and he is transported. He goes into a trance, and he sees himself as in a past life, as one of the Holy Roman Emperors, possessing the spear and using it as his talisman of power to rule the empire. And he comes back to himself and wonders, what the hell just happened?
Yeah.
And goes off on researching this thing and becomes absolutely obsessed with it.
And let's give out your websites here. It's jerryesmith.com. And that's JerryeSmith.com, SMITH. And for information about the book, it's spearbook.com. That's SPEARBOOK.com. And if you want to just pick up the book, if you want to just call the number is 1-800-718-4514. And that's the Adventures Unlimited press order line.
Righto. 1-800-718-4514. Call during normal business hours, and Beth and Mary will be happy to take your order.
Yes, and tell them you heard the interview on Banal America Audio.
Now, to get an autograph copy, go to Spearbook. At spearbook.com, you can get a copy autographed by both the authors. If you call Beth or Mary at Adventures Unlimited Press at 1-800-718-4514, if you tell them you want an autograph copy, I will autograph one to you. But it won't have George's autograph. You got to go to spearbook.com to get George's autograph.
Okay.
Or you can just go to amazon.com, or you can go to barnesandnoble.com, or you can go to your local Barnes & Noble. It's in all major bookstores.
Awesome.
And you can get it at amazon.com for a discount, but no autographs.
That does it for this week's edition of Banal of America Audio. Big thanks to Jerry E. Smith for sitting down and talking to us. He's going to be back next week with more. We're going to talk about the spear, going into World War II, how Hitler got it, what Hitler did with it once he had it, Himmler and his esoteric interests, the mysterious death of Hitler, where the spear may have gone when Hitler died, the rumors of Nazi Antarctic bases is going to be discussed in depth, and we talk for a good portion of time about Jerry's old friend Jim Keith, the late great Jim Keith. Jerry tells us about his life and times, real education on someone who is sorely missed in the esoteric world, and so much more. That's next week, March 11th, 2006, on Banal of America Audio. Big thanks, of course, to Leslie, Chiron, and R. Lee of BanalofAmerica.com for your help and support with the audio series. Check out their columns at BanalofAmerica.com. Check out BanalofAmerica.com for daily updates, all kinds of stuff, satire, columns, feature articles, and tons more. And, of course, if you are a frequent BanalofAmerica.com visitor, if you enjoy the audio, if you want to help out a little bit, click the PayPal button at BanalofAmerica.com or the one on our audio page and make a donation to BanalofAmerica.com. Every little bit counts. Every little bit helps. We appreciate it. Much thanks. Thanks to everybody listening out there, all of you who discovered us as a result of last week's big Lauren Coleman interview, or those of you who've been with us all along, thank you so much. We've got tons of great interviews in the pipeline, coming down the pike. Of course, I already previewed next week with Jerry E. Smith, so there's not much left to say for this week. Thanks for listening, folks. This is Tim Banal, signing off.